The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with me, Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The president of the Southern Baptist Seminary sues over vaccine mandates.
The way that the Biden administration has chosen is a direct subversion of religious liberty.
The Supreme Court takes up a Second Amendment case.
You just can't go and say that you live in a dangerous neighborhood. They claim that you have to have specific threats against you.
The Rittenhouse trial takes a turn.
It wasn't until you pointed your gun at him, with your gun, now your hands down, pointed at him, that he fired, right?
Correct.
And over a dozen Republicans helped the House pass the infrastructure bill.
Why would those 13 Republicans give Biden what he so desperately needed?
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. On July 25th, the White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, had this conversation with the media.
Is that a sign that perhaps the federal government should step in and issue mandates? And if not, are you putting the needs of unvaccinated people ahead of the needs of vaccinated people?
One, that's not the role of the federal government. That is the role that institutions, private sector entities, and others may take. That certainly is appropriate. Also, local communities are going to take steps they need to take.
Since that time, the Biden administration has decided that it is, in fact, the role of the federal government to force vaccine mandates on businesses with more than 100 employees. All businesses, public and private. And businesses are just now fighting back, as are nonprofits and institutions of higher learning. Among them, the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, a private Christian institution. The president of the seminary, Dr. Albert Mohler, is a longtime friend of mine. He joined me on The Hugh Hewitt Show. So what did the federal government tell you to do, Dr. Mohler?
Well, we had heard about what the Biden vaccine mandate was likely to be. The president had made the comments. Members of his administration had made comments. And what was clear was that the purpose of the administration was to transform employers into agents of the state, basically arms of the administrative state. And in this case, when you're talking about a religious employer, you're talking about very dangerous territory. And by the time the rule was finally promulgated and we saw what it was, this would indeed turn a religious institution into a coercive arm of the government. And that is just a precedent that that no religious institution should allow.
My position on vaccines is great that they're here. I've been vaccinated. I've had a booster. I think you agree with me, Al, right? Vaccinations are a very good thing. And God bless everyone out there who is getting a vaccination, who's checked and figured it out. So, Dr. Mohler, later today, I'm going to do a podcast with Andy Slavitt, who was President Obama's number two on vaccines, because he knows I agree with vaccinations generally. He knows I've been a prophet for getting vaccinated. But I'm going to have to explain to him why this doesn't make any sense and why it is deeply offensive and indeed dangerous. What would you say to him?
Well, the first thing I would say is that when you're talking about a mandate, and you are talking about an issue in which there's a legitimate, genuine, religious difference of opinion. It's very dangerous for the federal government to become involved in this in any way. But the particular way that the government has decided to do this, the mechanism it has chosen, is to use employers as the instruments of its will. And when that employer is a religious employer, every single alarm bell we know should go off in terms of religious liberty, and in terms of the danger of state power. If the government wants to do this, it would have mechanisms to do it that would be at least free from this onerous complication, which I believe is blatantly unconstitutional. Now, whether it should or not is a different question. But the way that the Biden administration has chosen to promulgate and to apply this rule is a direct subversion of religious liberty. of a Christian institution. But the fact is, whatever is right now in place by federal law, we comply with, does not constitute an infringement of conscience on an issue in which the church does not have a position. In other words, it is an issue in which these religious liberty issues are not implicated.
So, Dr. Moeller, the Fifth Circuit's already ruled in favor of a pause. What do you expect to hear from the Sixth Circuit, and when do you expect to hear it?
Well, I hope the court recognizes this as a direct threat to religious liberty and acts in order to relieve that violation by means of whatever it may choose as a way of discharging this rule. And by the way, just to make it clear, we offer the vaccine to our employees on the campus.
For the entire conversation with Dr. Moeller, please go to townhallreview.com. Citizens who seek the right to carry a concealed weapon have few rights in the state of New York, but the Supreme Court could soon change that as they consider a challenge to the state's law. John Lott, the author of The War on Guns, discussed the case with Bob France on AM 1420, The Answer, out of Cleveland.
Tell us what the litigants are claiming would be, or are they suggesting we would have to show as proper cause or good reason for us to be able to do what the Constitution tells us we can do?
Well, it was kind of arbitrary exactly what the reasons is. I mean, you have individual either judges or sheriffs or police chiefs who make that decision whether or not somebody has a good enough reason for being able to go and defend themselves outside the home. And one of the points in the case, and it really wasn't argued against very much, was the fact that you can have two different judges in the same county who will look at the same set of facts and come to very different decisions whether somebody has a good reason or not. But the main thing in New York and six other states that have these types of may issue rules, including California and New Jersey and Maryland, is that you just can't go and say that you live in a dangerous neighborhood. They claim that you have to have specific threats against you. And, you know, obviously there are plenty of cases one can go and point to where people had specific death threats and still were not allowed to defend themselves. There are cases where women have had restraining orders against others and still not been allowed to go and get a gun to be able to carry for self-defense. But there are two basic arguments that were raised. One was public safety. New York was claiming that this was important to restrict the issuance of concealed carry in order to preserve public safety. And, of course, the other side, Paul Clement, would go and say, look, we got 43 other states that don't have this restriction. You know, there are many large cities that don't have this restriction, and we don't have the problems that you claim. I mean, anybody who's followed the right to carry law debate over time knows that when different states have passed these laws, there have been predictions, just like the state of New York was making, that there'd be disasters that would be occurring, that there would be blood in the streets, that people would be behaving irresponsibly. And yet, you know, that's never happened. And none of the states that have adopted right to carry or constitutional carry, has there even been a legislative hearing to undo that part of the rules, to make it so that there would be the discretion again. And the second part of the argument that came up was, as Chief Justice Roberts was asking, and others once, Kavanaugh, was saying, look, what other part of the Bill of Rights do you have to go and provide a good reason to some public official why you should be able to exercise that? If you're going to be a reporter, do you have to go and get approval before you can become a reporter from some public official? Or if you're going to have a church, do you have to go and get approval from some public official that they think you have a good reason for the church? Or make a speech? Do you have to go and get a license and approval and demonstrate a good reason? I mean, none of those even require a license, let alone require that you have to go and get public approval for the, you know, you as a person, or for the reason why you want to exercise those things. So those were two of the major things that were there. And I think most people who listen to the arguments think that, at least on the question that was before the court, and that is whether or not a good reason needs to be provided, I think New York's going to lose.
Yeah, I've been looking at some of the coverage of that and just looking at analyses, and I agree. It looks like the majority of people who are writing about this, who are watching it closely, are saying that the court kind of has signaled that they will strike down these restrictions. You wrote a book 23 years ago called More Guns and Less Crime, which dealt with right to carry. Is what has changed from two decades ago to today as it pertains to, again, concealed carry or even open carry, but public carrying of weapons outside of the home for protection?
Right. Well, in fact, my book, More Guns, Less Crime, from the University of Chicago Press, dealt specifically with the issue that was before the court, and that is what happens when you move from a may issue type law to a so-called right to carry or shall issue type law. And one thing you see is a lot more people getting concealed handgun permits. But you see drops in crime. Just as higher arrest rates or higher conviction rates or longer prison sentences make it riskier for criminals to go and commit crime, the fact that a would-be victim might be able to go and defend themselves also makes it riskier for criminals to commit crime and deter crime. And what you find is that permit holders are incredibly law-abiding. We had a lot in the book in the three editions. The last one came out in 2010. But in the Crime Prevention Research Center, you can see our reports at crimeresearch.org. You look at the most recent data from Texas and Florida, and you find that concealed carry permit holders are convicted of firearms-related violations at 1/12 the rate that the police officers are. I mean, police officers are rarely convicted of firearm-related violations. You know, crimes committed with firearms, they're convicted at 1/20 the rate of the general population. It's like 5% of the rate of the general population. But permit holders are convicted at a much, much lower rate than even police officers are. So, you know, the types of fears that were raised in the hearing are no different than what you see in legislative debates. And as I say, you look at legislative debates and the aftermath, you know, normally you'll see like 6 months after a right to carry law has been adopted or constitutional carry law has been adopted, you'll see news stories saying, well, you know, what's happened, or a year after, you'll see what happens. And time after time, they say none of the bad predictions have occurred, and it becomes a non-issue in the state. Nobody even tries to overturn the law.
Coming up, Republicans help Biden get his infrastructure bill through the House.
Why would those 13 Republicans give Biden what he so desperately needed?
A town hall review returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Kyle Rittenhouse is on trial on 6 charges, including first-degree intentional homicide. The then 17-year-old killed 2 people and wounded another during the riots in Kenosha, Wisconsin last summer. Rittenhouse claims it was self-defense. While some media reports of the trial may give you the impression that Rittenhouse is one step away from a guilty verdict, the trial this week had a dramatic turn. Judge Bruce Schroeder was animated as he addressed Assistant DA Thomas Binger's effort to incriminate Rittenhouse based on the young man's silence.
Pardon me?
That was before the
defense
testimony.
Don't get brazen with me. You knew very well that an attorney can't go into these types of areas when the judge has already ruled without asking outside the presence of the jury to do so. So don't give me that.
Former U.S. Attorney Andrew McCarthy joined Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer out of Chicago.
with your arms up in the air, he never fired, right?
Correct.
It wasn't until you pointed your gun at him, advanced on him, with your gun, now your hands down, pointed at him, that he fired, right?
Correct.
Is that Gross Kretz testimony to, if you'll excuse the phrase, a kill shot for the prosecution?
Well, they haven't had much go right for them from what I can detect, and I do think this is a very political prosecution. It's one where I don't think that professional prosecutors who were just applying the law would ever have brought this case. This was, you know, obviously brought by political pressure. And I think their theory is one that ought to frighten people, because if they're correct about this, then you have to wonder what's left of self-defense, which is the natural right that undergirds the Second Amendment. And that is this idea that let's put the first shooting aside. All the victims, so-called, that were shot after that, their theory is that even if they were not threatening, or even if they were threatening Rittenhouse, they were provoked by his first shooting, and they were trying to interrupt an active shooter. And that, number one, has no bearing whatsoever on whether Rittenhouse perceived a threat and was allowed to defend himself. But if it's right, then you have no right to self-defense anymore.
Well, and the other thing about this, they sort of argued in the alternative, at least a pre-trial, which is, you know, and this is sort of the non-legal argument that's out in the public arena. You know, what was this 18-year-old doing with a rifle roaming the streets of Kenosha that night? Well, you know, the response to that, it seems to me, is, well, wait a second. I mean, that city was up for grabs. The police had lost control of the city, so he's out protecting himself. Whether you think it's judicious or not for him to be, you know, actively on the street patrolling, if you will, or looking to provide aid and comfort to people that are under threat of violence, whether you think that's a smart thing or not, it's not illegal for him to do that.
Yeah, I also think it's the kind of thing, Dan, that a good judge would have kept out of the case. If somebody is guilty, they have to be guilty on the elements of the things that are charged. You don't get to convict them because they were out doing something stupid or something that, you know, you think is unwise and can't be explained. You can't convict them because on other occasions they did things that were condemnable. The only way you're supposed to be able to convict people is if you have proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the elements of the things that they're actually charged with. And if you charge someone with murder, then being an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old who was out on the street and shouldn't have had a gun, and that was an irresponsible set of choices, you can condemn that until the cows come home. It's got nothing to do with whether he committed murder.
The giant infrastructure bill, passed by the United States Senate on a bipartisan basis, was stuck in the House, mixed up with the Build Back Better agenda. While most Democrats wanted the infrastructure bill passed in the House, progressives were upset that the Build Back Better bill had been stalled by Republicans and wasn't going anywhere fast in the Senate either. So they refused to help Nancy Pelosi and Republicans bring the bill forward. It eventually came forward after the Virginia elections wiped out Democrats in that state, and 13 Republicans voted in favor of it. Many conservatives were upset, among them Salem host Mike Gallagher.
Just before midnight on Friday, we witnessed an utterly disgraceful act by a group of 13 House Republicans. Given the chance to deal a severe blow to President Biden's flailing agenda, they instead rescued him by providing Speaker Nancy Pelosi with the votes she needed to overcome resistance from the far left of her party. For months, Biden's multi-trillion-dollar domestic agenda has been mired in problems. And the goal of the Democrats has been to pass trillions of dollars of new spending at a time when debt as a share of the economy is at historic levels. The strategy all along was for Democrats to win over some Republicans to their cause by creating a charade that their agenda was actually divided into two parts, a physical infrastructure bill and a sweeping social welfare bill. Now, for months, as we know, we've witnessed Democrats have been battling among themselves, with some members more attached to the infrastructure bill and others more attached to the social welfare bill. But ultimately, it became clear that the two bills are inextricably linked and they would rise and fall together. Now, on Friday night, after months of back and forth, it looked like Biden's agenda could suffer another massive setback, because not all the progressives were sold on the idea of agreeing to pass the infrastructure bill with only a commitment from holdouts in the House that they would vote for the social spending bill in a few weeks, once the Congressional Budget Office analysis comes out. With only three no votes to spare, Pelosi lost six Democrats, enough to sink the bill. It would have ended. The Democrats would have suffered a massive political defeat. And yet, 13 Republicans swooped in to rescue Nancy Pelosi, providing Biden with the biggest victory of his presidency and put the rest of his reckless agenda on a glide path to passage in the House. Why would 13 Republicans, Brian Fitzpatrick, Don Bacon, Don Young, Fred Upton, Adam Kinzinger, Jeff Van Drew, John Katko, Tom Reed, Andrew Garbarino, Nicole Malliotakis, Chris Smith, David McKinley, Anthony Gonzalez. Why would those 13 Republicans give Biden what he so desperately needed? Biden entered this week reeling from a devastating rebuke of his presidency by voters in areas of the country thought to be reliably Democratic. He heads into 2022 a wounded animal, and Republicans stood to make major gains. Instead, these 13 Republicans tossed him a life raft and allowed him to put bipartisan gloss on his radical agenda. Every Republican who voted for this monstrosity should be primaried and defeated by candidates who will actually resist the left-wing agenda.
Coming up, Dennis Prager got COVID. Some celebrated. Really, they did.
I was supposed to die. I'm sure I disappointed. I'm not sure I know that I disappointed many.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
I can't breathe. This is David Horowitz. Those three words have rocked the nation. The violence that followed George Floyd's death has opened new cultural fault lines in America.
David Horowitz's new book is entitled I Can't Breathe, How a Racial Hoax is Killing America. This book tells the truth about so-called police racism and the lies being told by the Black Lives Matter movement. Get the new book, I Can't Breathe, by best-selling author David Horowitz, available at Amazon or wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. My friend and colleague, Dennis Prager, does not fear COVID. He doesn't wear a mask in public. He isn't vaccinated. And then at age 73, Dennis contracted the virus. He was very lucky. He didn't struggle during his relatively brief illness. He recovered quickly. He's fine. He is one of the blessed ones. He joined fellow Salem host Seth Leibson on AM 960, The Patriot, out of Phoenix, Arizona.
First of all, Dennis, I'm glad you and your family are all doing so well. What was the most surprising response or editorial or statement about you in the last month that you read?
It's a very good question. What was most surprised me was how much attention an offhanded comment that I made while I was still either recuperating or actually having COVID. It was so soon to my positive test for COVID that I broadcast, because I feel dedicated to my show. And
I actually may have still had COVID or was just getting out of it. And I was rather amazed at how much attention. I mean, the Washington Post printed an entire article, a whole piece, on me saying that I wanted to have natural immunity rather than a vaccination. And I'll tell you, the biggest surprise, since that's what you asked, is probably, aside from the amount of attention it got, was I actually believe, and I don't think I ever engage in hyperbole, or I try not to. I think the CDC came out with a statement a couple of days later, which I believe is not true. In other words, I think it's a lie, that the vaccine is better than natural immunity for preventing a recurrence of any serious infection or virus. And I am pretty certain they did it as a result of all the attention my comment got.
I wouldn't be surprised. You're not supposed to exist. I mean, you're not supposed to exist because the media has done what I think is a macabre thing, which is when you search this stuff, you find story after story after story about local talk show hosts. Maybe you knew some of them. I didn't happen to, who have died. And that kind of the subtext of which is they deserved to because they were against the vaccine. So you weren't supposed to exist, Dennis. They had to send you to Coventry here.
That's a very good point, Seth. I was supposed to die. I'm sure I disappointed. I'm not sure I know that I disappointed many.
Yeah.
Because if you read the comments of Washington Post readers, and remember, these are people who subscribe to the Washington Post. I don't think you can comment if you don't have a subscription because you don't have access to the articles without a subscription.
Right.
And the number of people who wanted me to die is remarkable. I really believe had I shot five people, there would not have been as many calls for my death. The anger that those of us who believe that natural immunity is more significant than vaccinated immunity. And I never even denied that there was immunity to the vaccine. That's the irony.
Sure.
I never attacked the vaccine. Nope. I simply said I prefer natural immunity.
Right.
Which I do. And I thank God that I have it now and that I was well. And that what really also bugged them is that I said, I both implied and said that I believe that I did so well.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike those talk show hosts who, like you, I had never heard of,
yeah,
which is only important in that the hard left went looking for him is what I think that means.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Collectively,
correct.
We've been in this business 100
right.
years or something.
The belief is that these. The things that I took, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and zinc, vitamin D, etc., they don't matter. In fact, the New York Times, which really lies about it, dismisses ivermectin as a horse dewormer. That's the term they always use. The whole left uses horse dewormer.
Right.
It was actually discovered or created by an eminent doctor who got the Nobel Prize in Medicine for creating ivermectin for people.
Yep.
Not as a horse dewormer.
Yep.
So it's a total lie when they say that's what ivermectin is. It's a lie. But the left lies because, as I've said my whole life, truth is not a left-wing value.
Coming up, taking on cancel culture.
The only way, the really effective way to push back against it is to stand down and stare down the bullies.
Kimberly Strassel in the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Across the country, parents are not just waking up to the fact that some educators are indoctrinating their children. They are fighting back in many school districts. They're attending the board meeting, demanding answers, protesting on the streets, pulling their kids out of bad schools. In some cases, they are running for office. The results in Virginia sent shivers down the spines of the far left. Not just conservatives have awoken, but parents across the political spectrum. Wall Street Journal editor Kimberly Strassel discussed the turn of events while on the Mark Davis Show on 660 AM, The Answer, out of Dallas, Texas.
Virginia seems to be an answer, because what can we do about that? Vote against it when we have the opportunity. I don't want to overinvest in this, but it does seem like people are starting to get a whiff of the dangers of cancel culture, finally. I mean, do you think?
Absolutely. And I think you just put your finger on it. The only way, the really effective way to push back against it is to stand down and stare down the bullies. And, you know, the Virginia thing is also very relevant, because the parents who were showing up there, the thing that was really quite scary wasn't that these school officials were not only at times not letting them speak or holding sessions in secret to deny them their voices. But it was that letter that came from the Department of Justice, from Attorney General Merrick Garland, that said, you know, we're going to be investigating you. That's a sheer intimidation threat. And it's designed, you know, in its own way to cancel, to make people stop engaging in the activities that they're engaging in. And that's why we use that word, the chilling of free speech. Right. It's not that anyone comes and puts a roll of duct tape over your mouth and says you're not allowed to talk. It's that the threat of what will happen to you if you do is so great that you choose not to. And so it was very inspiring to see all those people continue to come out and vote and really continue to come to those meetings and let everyone know. And then, like you said, Dave Chappelle, we're going to need figures, prominent figures in society, who step up like that and say it's okay to push back. And to put some perspective around this and remind everyone that, as you said, speech is things that can sometimes be hurtful to folks. It can sometimes be enlivening. It can sometimes be humor. But it's guaranteed either way under the Constitution in most scenarios. Remember when the IRS cracked down on conservative nonprofits, targeted them, send out those letters. There were all those Wisconsin prosecutors who went after conservative nonprofits, really on very bogus grounds. That ended up going all the way up to the state Supreme Court there, and free speech and free association won out. But it was a very long haul for people. Or these organized campaigns against companies, which I would say that's a little bit more depressing. I think that those have succeeded far more, which is why you're seeing all these woke CEOs issuing their woke edicts in companies, because they got the lesson. They're scared of boycotts. They're scared of all these outside activist groups coming and attempting to hurt their share price. But that book was very much about the left having figured out that if you band together and you issue threats, you can change behavior. And rather than go through our normal civil discourse where we debate and we argue good ideas and we vote, it was much more about taking things into their own hands. And we're seeing that all over the place.
Now, speaking of free speech, people can like or not like Donald Trump. They can celebrate or deride him. But the Trump hatred cult, the Lincoln Project ne'er-do-well, where do you think that stands now? Is the Lincoln Project coven, are they broken? Are they discredited? Or will they, are they like cockroaches that you can never fully get rid of them?
Well, the real theme of the book was that people on both sides, you know, and as you said, they come from all walks of life, but whose hatred of a particular political figure, and I'm with you, you can like Donald Trump or not like Donald Trump, but we ought to run the rules of society the same way regardless. And what you saw with all these folks was this argument that was constantly being made that Donald Trump was such a threat to society, to political norms, that they were entitled to break all the norms themselves. And we're still dealing with the fallout of that. I mean, look, for instance, just last week, we had this latest indictment from U.S. Special Prosecutor
John Durham on everything that went back to the beginning of this Russia probe from the FBI. You know, this was a group of people within government, James Comey and others, who felt as though they didn't need to follow all the normal standards because they thought, I don't know what they thought. But we're still dealing with the fallout of that. You know, I'm one of those people who I think impeachment is a very important tool that you have, but you don't use it lightly because you water it down and then people are going to think that it's a regular routine part of the political divide just because you don't like the other guy's politics that you're going to whip it out. And you see Republicans now who have already called for impeaching Joe Biden. And so the idea behind this was that when you get in that mentality and then you yourself become the norm breaker, but you claim you're doing it for good purposes, you're not in the long run. We have these rules. We are a nation of the rule of law and the rule of standards and procedures as well, too. We need to stick to them for the good of society overall.
Last thing, you're starting to notice something, and I am too, and that is the dangers and the pushback when liberal people peel away from hard leftism and start to dare to sound somewhat rational. What is at play here?
Yeah, I'll give you one more example here, too. I just read a story this morning in Politico about Buffalo Mayor Byron Brown, who, of course, was defeated in a primary earlier this year by a Democratic Socialist Progressive. He then staged a write-in campaign and won his re-election in the city of Buffalo. And now the progressives are calling to strip him from his position on the Democratic National Committee because they claim that it was unfair and incorrect of him to somehow go around the regular primary process. I mean, look, it was all above board, but they're angry about this. I remember watching this myself when Republicans during the rise of the Tea Party, there was a lot of bitterness and acrimony within the party. You're seeing that in the Democratic Party now. They're going to have to war that out and see where we end. I hope that those that are more reasonable and rational are going to win that fight. I certainly think the message of the election last week was that the electorate is much more in the same place as those who are more reasonable and rational. But this is something that the Democratic Party itself is going to have to battle.
Coming up, a major city decides to stop enforcing some basic laws.
This is in the family, if you will, of police reductions.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, the elusive but essential virtue of humility.
What humility does is profess before God, you are God, and I am not.
Government overreach on vaccine mandates.
Standing at the door of McDonald's, the vaccine police will be there. Hey, little boy, show me your papers.
The throttling back of First Amendment free expression by big tech.
We're in a time of great conformity. We're in a time where you're not allowed to, like, speak outside of very specific boundaries.
And the deliberate manipulation of language itself.
We can go back to George Orwell. The party in power was destroying the language because it didn't want people to think.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Like many large cities in the United States today, the city of Philadelphia is run by progressives who see racism around every corner. And they make some stunning decisions based upon that premise. Here's Dennis Prager.
Philadelphia became the first major U.S. city to ban police stops for minor traffic violations in an effort to reduce harmful interactions between law enforcement and people of color. Mayor Jim Kenney signed legislation 2 weeks after the city council voted 14-2 in favor of the policy, which will limit traffic stops to primary violations that threaten public safety. This is council member Isaiah Thomas. To many people who look like me, a traffic stop is a rite of passage. We pick out cars, we determine routes, we plan our social interactions around the fact that it is likely that we will be pulled over by police, said council member Isaiah Thomas, who introduced the ordinance. By removing the traffic stops that promote discrimination rather than public safety, city council has made our streets safer and more equitable. The new rule targets secondary violations, quote-unquote, that include things such as expired registration. So, no longer in Philadelphia will it matter if you register your car? Is that correct? It strikes me that that's a pretty serious thing, if you don't register your car. But not anymore in Philadelphia. A single broken piece taillight. So you won't be stopped if you don't have one of your taillights functioning. Missing inspection and emissions testing certificates. I'd like to know what else, too. Okay. This is in the family, if you will, of police reductions. We want to minimize police interactions with people of color, and the easiest way to do that is to reduce the number of police or let people steal. That was my column last week. Stealing wrong, not on the left. NPR had that in defense of looting author on NPR last year.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producers Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards and Ben Brigman, David Pochon, Adam Ramsey, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.